don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Cryptoconomy Podcast. I got another quick read today that's by Daniel Goldman, who we read one of his works not too long ago, another one on the Abacus Crypto Journal, and I think he actually tagged me in this one, but I really enjoyed this one. This one's more of a, it's written more as a story and hypothetical situation, which I think kind of sheds some additional light on it, and it's very much... is trying to give a perspective in the more the anti-blockchain sense. So I figured it might be a really good addition to our conversation about this. Again, it was by Daniel Goldman at the Abacus Crypto Journal, and it's titled, What We Talk About When We Talk About Blockchain Technology. A thought experiment. Imagine, if you will, it's the year 2000. You're making Y2K jokes, reeling over the Star Wars prequels, witnessing an American presidential election that by your naive, doe-eyed standards feels stressful, etc., etc. You're also bearing witness to something else, this new, strange, emergent phenomenon called peer-to-peer file-sharing networks. Although you've yet to take the time to learn how this P2P technology functions, a few things are clear to you. 1. It works. You and your friends have been using Napster, Kazaa, Nutella, and others, and have been able to download music and movies at no cost. Nobody needs to sit down and explain the value of this to you, because you've perceived it with your own eyes and ears. 2. It all feels a bit Wild Wild West, a movie, incidentally, you walked out of 6 months ago. The software interfaces for these tools are usable to non-tech geeks, but just barely. They certainly don't have the level of shine and gloss of the UIs you're accustomed to on your new fancy Dell running Windows in 98. The whole experience of participating in these strange networks, from finding and installing the software itself, to seeking out and eventually downloading digital content, feels less like the increasingly polished world of web commerce than some weird dark web hacker cypherpunk shenanigans, a culture which, up to this point, you've only heard about from an intelligent but increasingly suspicious friend of yours. 3. There's good reason to think that many people with money and power desperately want to stop this technology from spreading, namely, the music and movie industries, for the obvious reason that people across the world having access to their product for free severely undercuts their business model, and the federal government, because, let's be frank, this is clearly illegal as all hell. And yet, despite all of this money and political muscle being utilized to attempt to shut down these networks, including the arrest of a 12-year-old girl you could have sworn you read, they persist virtually unscathed. From this, you conclude that however this technology is working, it's doing something quite powerful and unprecedented. Now let's suppose in this hypothetical thought experiment of ours, somebody approaches you one day. Let's call him Joe Finance Guy. Joe is in his mid-50s and prides himself on his knack for detecting the latest trends in the tech industry and capitalizing on them, a claim whose validity is evinced by his gains in his investments during the dot-com boom. While he readily admits he has limited technical knowledge of computer science, cybersecurity, or really anything software related, he still insists that that's no hindrance for him, given his penchant for surrounding himself with the right people. Needless to say, Joe has had his eyes on the P2P revolution, spotting what he suspects is the next big thing, and noticing that, in its current state, no single entity seems to be making vast sums of money off of it. Joe is feeling his business-minded ears perk up. So today, he's called you into his office for a modest proposal. Here, he says, is the plan. We're starting a business. Our company will advance peer-to-peer technology to its next phase, digital content sharing 2.0. if you will. For the first time, the technology will be rescued from the scary realm of hackers and privacy and so on, and into the world of mainstream institutions. What we'll do is set up our own peer-to-peer network in which our private, registered company controls all of the nodes in the system. What this means is that things will work much more smoothly. Search queries and network traffic can be coordinated by our central servers, making things far more efficient. We'll hire the best designers and UX experts we can find, so the whole thing will feel cleaner, polished, inviting. And of course, we'll work with authorities and regulators to smooth out all those messy legal issues, so we eliminate all the downsides of peer-to-peer networks by keeping it all under our control. But because we're still utilizing the same technological infrastructure, we'll preserve the benefits. After all, the real power here is the technology. Remember, you said it yourself. What are you to make of this proposal? All upsides with no downsides certainly sounds enticing. Is this your chance to cash in big on a paradigm-shifting trend at just the right moment? Never one to shirk due diligence, you go home and embark on your first real research deep dive into peer-to-peer network architecture. And here's what you come to realize. Joe is completely wrong. His idea rests entirely on a lack of understanding of the technology he's talking about. In fact, it could be argued that, despite his slick presentation, what he proposed actually offers nothing but downsides. In your second official meeting with Joe, you take your best shot at explaining. Technology is often best understood by what motivates its creation. We've had open internet access for years, but it wasn't until the emergence of peer-to-peer networks that this proliferation of free file sharing was made possible. What is it then that this new technology is actually offering? Or conversely, why did we never see a similar outcome, free digital content sharing, achieved with the traditional web toolkit client-server architecture? What were the impediments? For simplification, we can distill these impediments down to two. One, limited hard disk space. Image, audio, and video files take up an awful lot of hard drive space. For one company to maintain a database of every song that you've ever heard of would be prohibitively expensive, to say the least. Two, risk of censorship. For better and or worse, there exist these things called intellectual property laws. If a company is illegally distributing massive amounts of data illegally, the FBI just has to show up at their door and down it all goes. What's made peer-to-peer architecture so paradigm-shifting is how it solved these two problems. In the case of data storage, no single party has to host it all. Anybody with a standard household computer can run the software and seed whatever data they choose. Most people have plenty of excess hard drive space and bandwidth on their personal computers anyway, and running a node is easy and convenient enough that enough people seem to be doing it to keep the network alive. Thus, instead of a massive burden of financial cost falling onto one entity, the cost is distributed widely enough among many parties to make it virtually non-existent. As for legal censorship, these nodes are numerous enough and geographically distributed enough that it becomes infeasible to shut the network down. Most files, especially files users are most interested in, get duplicated dozens or even hundreds of times across different nodes. This forces authorities to play a Sisyphean game of whack-a-mole. At best, they can occasionally shut down a major node or two, but given how many there are and the fact that there are constantly new ones going live, this does little to stop the network from functioning or even slowing down. Which is to say, while the benefits of peer-to-peer are indeed technological, this is software, after all. Analyzing the tech in isolation misses the point. The technological utility here is inextricably linked to its utility from an economic, political, and even social perspective. In short, the real-world context this technology lives in is what matters, not just the software itself. Re-examining Joe's proposal, where it fundamentally differs from existing peer-to-peer networks is that the company will be running the whole system. So consider the burden you are now taking on. They have to pay to keep all the nodes in the network running, which, recall all the duplication and redundancy involved, will be not just pointless. Why bother storing 100 copies of a file that you own anyway? but also far more expensive than the already prohibitively expensive, hypothetical, case of storing a giant music library in a queryable database. And additionally, now all the FBI needs to do is confiscate your server keys and smash your hard drives, which they almost certainly will, and your whole system is toast. What you've done is created a system that's expensive, slow, and easy to dismantle by hackers, authorities, or anyone in between. You may as well save yourself time and money and build the thing using the client-server architecture of most of the net. In which case, of course, you'd still ultimately run into the same problems. So you'd be required to come up with brand new business models, figure out new legal frameworks for handling intellectual property, and yes, sure, you'd also need some technological advances. And who knows, maybe some giant multinational corporations years from now will manage to do just that, ushering in a future online downloading and streaming of digital tunes and flicks. But let's be clear, those technological advances have essentially nothing to do with those of peer-to-peer networks. The idea of a Kazaa-esque peer-to-peer network entirely controlled by one entity is nonsense, which is why it hasn't happened yet and why it never will. An actual experiment. Fast forward to the year 2018. Sorry, but we must. Here we all find ourselves trying to make sense of blockchain technology, and all of the bold, confusing, seemingly contradictory claims surrounding its purported benefits. If you don't work in blockchain tech but know somebody who does, there's a good chance that you're sick of hearing about it. But bear with me, our neat little peer-to-peer tech proposal analogy should set us up to better understand some thorny confusion around blockchain, about what exactly its value proposition is, and why its supposed limitations, and certain proposed solutions to said limitations, may not be what they appear. In a word, what blockchain gives you is disintermediation. More to the point, they give you disintermediation in managing the ownership and transfer of digital commodities. Note 1. For the sake of it, let's just use commodities as a catch-all term for that which has monetary value, so that we don't get lost trying to determine exactly the line between currency, digital assets, goods, etc. Unlike physical commodities, which take time and resources to duplicate, digital commodities are represented as bits on a hard drive, and bits can be duplicated for free, for all intents and purposes. Free duplication is no small issue for commodities, which obviously lose their economic value without scarcity. Thus, in the pre-blockchain digital stone age, managing digital commodities required granting authority to a trusted third party, or TTP. The trusted third party processes all financial transactions and is ultimately responsible of managing and updating the canonical data ledger, their own digital representation of ownership. Why might we want alternatives to TTPs? Aren't they functioning just fine, or at least well enough, as is? Cryptocurrency advocates argue that the use of intermediaries is so fundamentally built into the way we think about electronic payments that many fail to notice the incredible cost that we're constantly absorbing. Even ideological grievances about financial institutions increasing concentrations of power, rendering them more prone to corruption, etc., aside, consider purely financial grievances. We may be doing more work than we need to be doing and are losing time and money in the process. Nick Szabo has convincingly argued that when it comes to computer security, TTPs inevitably evolve into the slowest, costliest, and riskiest component of a protocol. Keeping them honest, functional, and accountable requires layers upon layers of oversight and adjudication. These levels of oversight take many forms. Auditors, accountants, contracts, insurers, lawyers, and ultimately police, courts, judges, and hell, even bailouts, essentially the gears that typically run human civilization itself. Integrating these layers of human wetware, identity verification, transaction verification, regulatory compliance, into the fundamental components of what is otherwise dry software will, by necessity, burden and slow the system down and introduce all sorts of attack vectors. In short, computers are better at interacting with other computers than they are with people. Now, even if you don't buy into the theoretical underpinning laid out above, if we just temporarily grant that TTPs and a software protocol present risks, we can then categorize blockchains as existing at the extreme ends of the solution space. We start with software that requires the tightest security imaginable, money itself. And we not only ease reliance on third-party trust, but attempt to effectively eliminate it entirely. How can such a system still possibly be secure? Or put another way, what's replacing all of those human civilization underpinning levels of oversight discussed above? The bizarre answer, in essence, is that the burden of all that human work is being offloaded onto the software itself. This, quote, burden takes many forms. Blockchain nodes are limited in the amount of transactions they can process over a given amount of time. An investment of resources must be made to participate, either in the form of raw computational energy, proof of work, or putting up money as collateral, proof of stake. The details of which aren't important here. What matters is this. These aspects that make blockchains, quote, slow, are an intentional and deliberate way of avoiding reliance on trust and concentration of resources. Not just wonky computer science problems to be solved away with fancy algorithms. A typical computer science problem assumes a computer is under the control of the developer, who then tries to optimize for some metric of efficiency. The challenge of blockchain development, however, is to work without the fundamental assumption of control and figure out a way to best ensure that whoever runs the code will do so honestly. It's equal parts instructing computers and incentivizing the humans that run them. Which brings us back to poor, hapless Joe. When it comes to both peer-to-peer file sharing and blockchain networks, the, quote, inefficiencies are largely a means to an end, that end being decentralization, disintermediation, and censorship resistance. Working around these problems by centralizing it isn't a solution, it's simply giving up. But it's worse, because to whatever extent you naively maintain these costly components of the protocol is the extent you've now imposed empty costs on yourself. Like Joe thinking that running all 100 nodes on his peer-to-peer network himself is a good idea, a cryptocurrency on an entirely, quote, centralized blockchain unnecessarily takes on blockchain's burdens while achieving something that could be far more easily done with a good old-fashioned database. Hence the frustrations to the ears of a techie of hearing debates about the extent to which blockchain networks should be centralized, as though it's just one of the many factors to consider on your checklist, along with, say, transactions per second, fees, developer team, native features, etc. It's a bit like listening to a debate over the merits of various different airplane models, with one of their many equally weighted factors being whether or not the thing can even fly. Surely, if it never leaves the ground, then whatever it is, it shouldn't be called an airplane. Can we perhaps agree that your centralized thing shouldn't be called a blockchain? Note 2. A retort you'll sometimes hear to the stop calling it a blockchain complaint is that we should still call things blockchains so long as they have both blocks and chains, which admittedly is more persuasive than I'd like to admit. Now, of course, in the world of digital file sharing, centralized powerhouses did in fact win out in the end. Odds are that you use iTunes, Spotify, and Netflix more often than you do LimeWire and BitTorrent. So given that we're drawing parallels between peer-to-peer and blockchain tech here, it feels only fair to consider the possibility that Bitcoin and Ethereum will ultimately yield way to something similarly centralized and corporate. Exactly what this beast would look like, Amazon issuing its own purely digital token? Is hard to say. But hell, maybe it'll happen. I'm not here to claim that I can rule it out. Note 3. Though it feels like it would be dishonest to neglect to admit that the prospect does kind of scare the shit out of me. But what I submit to you is this. If Amazon Coin comes to be and Amazon decides they want complete control over its underlying protocol, and does anyone even pretend to imagine they wouldn't, Amazon will find they have no use for blockchain tech itself, and for the same fundamental reasons that iTunes has no use for peer-to-peer architecture. The economic viability of a particular industry and the utility of a particular piece of technology are two very different discussions. It could very well be the cryptocurrency trend will prime the world to embrace privately issued digital commodities. Claims about the future of blockchain tech itself, however, are another matter entirely. To many, it instinctually feels like the safest, most conservative bet to assume that the zany and unregulatable will yield to the boring, institutionalized, and corporate. But when you're talking about technology whose value proposition is, in effect, removing reliance on central parties, the, quote, safe bet turns on its head. Admittedly, there is something weirdly satisfying about witnessing this confusion play out. If blockchain tech can really do what the boldest among us suspect it might, the supposedly naive crypto-anarchist types may be the only ones actually grounded in reality, while the supposedly pragmatic, business-oriented, quote, it's about the technology, stupid, crowd may prove to be hopelessly confused. Speaking of confusion, here is one prediction. Projects will continue to emerge that intentionally muddy their true nature. They'll co-opt the language of truly open, distributed blockchain networks to obfuscate the fact that their technology positions them to be much more like a highly powered, concentrated, Amazon coin-esque player described above. The level of smoke and mirrors on this topic in the space is already astonishing. If, God bless you, you're some sort of an investor for whom sorting the wheat from the chaff is already literally a full-time job, I can do little more than to wish you the best of luck. Welcome to the future of money. Trust no one. All right, and that will conclude our article from Daniel Goldman and the Abacus Crypto Journal. I just really liked that article, and I kind of got sucked into it pretty quick. Usually when I'm sorting through a lot of these, I'll often have two or three that I read in full, and most of the other ones I'll read like a quarter of or a fifth of and then make a decision on it whether or not I feel like I'm having to force it to have a little bit of life. And I thought this one was good. It had kind of the story element, and I did a good job with the analogy for peer-to-peer networks. And I think he has a really good... I just really like that article. I enjoyed that one. I got about a quarter of the way through it and couldn't quite stop myself. So I thought that could be a good addition, particularly to the blockchain versus Bitcoin debate, that gave a really good superposition of what the hell blockchain tech is actually used for and liking it to the peer-to-peer network architecture. I will say one thing is with his note number three about it scares the shit out of him that maybe Amazon Coin and we'll just get a centralized alternative, which is a good point because that's certainly essentially what happened in the peer-to-peer network since. Granted, the peer-to-peer network is still massive and it continues to grow. So BitTorrent really didn't go anywhere. It just kind of morphed because the centralized and corporate alternatives actually committed to fulfilling the needs of the consumers. Because what we were seeing with BitTorrent was a complete rejection of shifting to the new technology because the old pricing structure was trying to be propped up. And there was a whole layer of distributors and even producers. There were like these two giant segments in the industry that were refusing to let go of their jobs. And when you're charging $20, which is to deal with the overhead of physical media and shipping stuff across the country and paying for the gas and these huge manufacturing plants to pump out CDs and DVDs and all this stuff, when you have that cost, they start transferring this to online, and they're like, yeah, $20 a movie. That's what we've always charged. And they want that profit, and they want to keep their jobs. So the shift there was just that they couldn't survive by making that adjustment, so they were failing to do so. And startups had to come up and prove to them, it's like, well, if you don't do it, you're going to get screwed. We're just going to wipe you out of the industry. Give us 10 years, we'll have our hardware ready, and you simply will be obsolete. And that's what happened. But in the sense of money, I think we're looking at a bit of a very different implication, because those centralized services simply adjusted properly to the new equilibrium pricing model. And all they needed to do, it was a failure to actually adopt the internet. And the peer-to-peer is still there for censorship resistance, for where they're trying to institute controls or limit the media access to certain people. And it still thrives specifically because of that reason. There's still a problem for it to route around. And until the open market adjusts to the fact that reality is not really there. The physical limitations don't exist on the internet. They're trying to take physical boundaries and re-implement them in a digital space that doesn't have them. They're just purposefully putting up barriers. In that same way, they wanted to charge the physical cassette manufacturing and pricing model on a digital distribution network or infrastructure, which just... that's just not going to happen. So when those companies came in and actually started to charge the proper distribution pricing model, the $10 a month, $15 a month for this huge ocean of content, rather than charging everybody individually, what that essentially amounted to was just them finally adopting the internet protocols and moving to the new equilibrium price. Whereas with Bitcoin, Bitcoin is a fundamentally new protocol. The internet doesn't really have a protocol for value exchange. They're just updating individual ledgers. I think we've already got those companies. Like, I think we're already seeing the shift to the internet pricing model with Square, or the Cash App and Venmo and Telegram and Apple Pay, all these things, which are essentially cutting out a lot of the excess cost by going fully digital. I think that's the more analogous situation to the old legacy media versus the Netflix and Hulu style and Spotify than actually the peer-to-peer and Bitcoin analogy. I think Bitcoin is actually a failure of monetary policies to maintain sound money. I think that's actually separate. I think trying to compare it to the old financial system, the problems in the financial system that result in unsound money are actually governance problems. They're monetary policy problems, because a retail bank can never survive if they're actually creating new money into thin air to fund debt. Like, that model's a Ponzi scheme, and it would crash in 6 years, 7 years tops, even if they could pile on a ton of obscurity and stuff. In a natural economy, that shit never survives. But the government has able, by monopolizing it and making it a legal monetary policy so that they can benefit from it themselves, so that they can start six wars that nobody really cares about. And if they ever saw it exit from their paycheck, they saw the $2,000 extra every month that they're spending on blowing up people in Pakistan or wherever the hell, they would be very, very pissed. But instead, they get angry at the market because the housing prices have jumped up 10%. And they don't realize that that is the cost. The housing prices went up by 10% because the government's issuing, the financial system is issuing new debt to pay for things that nobody can afford, and it has to adjust by inflating the currency and destroying the value of everybody's savings. Which is why we've just come to assume now that, oh, well, yeah, nobody saves anything to buy a house. You just 100% on debt. Yeah, nobody pays anything for school. 100% on debt. And shocking, all of those things are skyrocketing in price all the time. Who knew? So I think we're looking at a very different situation because we're not actually trying. I think the fundamental value case for Bitcoin is not actually competing with financial services. I think it's a protocol. I think it's undermining centralized distribution of monetary policy or centralized control of monetary policy. So I don't think Amazon Coin has any value whatsoever. So whereas Netflix actually competes with the physical distribution model and it can bring that equilibrium price down, Amazon Coin can do absolutely nothing to bring down the equilibrium price of monetary manipulation. Because it can't prevent that at all. The government will just come in and tell Amazon how to run their currency because they're centralized. So maybe I hope I explained that well. I'm kind of ranting here, but maybe that's something that can be explored in better detail later. Maybe I'll find an article or something on the topic. Maybe I'll write one. I don't know. I got too many things to write right now, and I'm in the process on like six. So, and they're slow going. But again, thank you, Daniel Goldman, for that article. I really enjoyed that one. We'll go ahead and just close this here. If you have any questions or want to make some comments, I think I want to... Twitter is not actually the greatest platform for that because the content moves so quickly. And I feel like it's rare for people to actually go to somebody's page and comment on stuff. It just either shows up in their feed and they retweet it, or it just gets lost. So I think I want to kind of move the conversation over to Reddit, just because it's always there and people can come back to it whenever they need to. So I want to push the crypto economy subreddit a little bit. So if you have any questions or comments, or you want to suggest an article for me to read on maybe the topic I discuss in this, please go to the subreddit, check it out. I'll have the episode posted and we can, you know, have a conversation underneath it. With that though, don't forget to check out r/cryptoeconomy. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter @thecryptoeconomy and Medium as well at the same tag. And of course, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and please share it with all your friends in the crypto space if they want to keep up with all the best discussions, articles, and topics going on in the crypto economy. You'll find it here at the Crypto Economy Podcast. Until next time, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.